This is Rewired Radio with Erica Spiegelman, addiction and wellness specialist, motivational speaker, and author, helping individuals, couples, and families regain a sense of control, leading to personal growth, wellness, and a more fulfilling life. Here's Erica Spiegelman.
Welcome, everyone. Conversations about addiction are usually focused on how it affects our mental, emotional, and psychological health. We very rarely talk about the moral issues raised by addiction. My guest today, Yeshaya Blakeney, has 12 plus years working in the addiction treatment field. Through his experience, Yeshaya has come to understand the importance of integrity in creating a new sober life and identity, and understands that we have to understand how integrity can work in all of our lives and what that is. Yeshaya will also talk to us today about how he defines integrity and why it matters in the recovery conversation. He's here to also help us understand how we can connect with what we are trying to recover when we embark on our unique sobriety journey. Yeshaya, welcome to the show. It is my honor, privilege, and pleasure to have you on today.
It's good to be with you too, Erica, again.
Yeah, you were one of my first guests, and there's always so much to talk to you about because you have such a wealth of knowledge and so many different aspects of recovery and life in general. So let's get started with the word integrity and what that means. There's so many clients that I deal with day in and day out that have no clue to what that means for them. And it's a conversation that I always have to start. So can you tell me a little bit about how you breach that conversation too?
Sure. So I'll tell you kind of what it means and then getting into the conversation with
Please,
clients.
Yeah.
So I grew up with this idea that integrity was kind of being good for your word, you know, so sort of trustworthiness. Mm-hmm. And then often people use an example like doing something good when nobody's looking. You know,
right.
I have some kind of, you know, personal integrity. My father, who's a developmental psychologist, has kind of a different way of seeing it through his own experience. And he thinks that integrity is actually a general kind of construct or idea where it's more about wholeness of character, right? The word integrity, the root of it is integer, right? A whole number. Mm. And so there's an idea of integrity, this idea of wholeness and general character. When we think about, let's say, the integrity of a bridge, it has two basic qualities. One is it has a strength of character. It can carry the weight of cars. Two is they build it in such a way that as things shift, it has a certain flexibility, or we could call it transformative potential that's inside of it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking about integrity in the broad sense, strength of character and the potential for transformation. And both of those are really necessary qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a working definition that we use at Recover Integrity. And in terms of introducing that to clients, it's complex on our side. We have kind of a whole curriculum built on integrity, which has to do with first understanding where people are out of integrity, kind of in what domains or areas of the personality. Secondly, reflecting that back to the client. Thirdly, going through some kind of pedagogical process, some sort of teaching and learning process to allow them to kind of... We use a stage model, so kind of grow to the next stage, so to speak, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and it's so important that it's called the Integrity Treatment Program, right?
Recover Integrity, yeah.
Recover Integrity. But at some point, that was the key of it, right? That was like the key word that kind of launched the, I think, the unique way in which you treat people and you help people is coming from this kind of perspective of, you know, really your core values have to change. And I don't think a lot of people talk about that as much. You know, a lot of people do put down the drink or the drug and they still carry on with behaviors that don't serve them. And they don't understand that it's really that their old behaviors aren't who they are. We have to create new identities and we have to actually understand what core values are and how to shift them, how to choose them. And it's a choice. It's a choice every day to choose integrity, to choose authenticity, to choose freedom.
Absolutely. And it's not, you know, obviously it's not just people in addiction treatment. You know, when we chose the name Recover Integrity, it was really for two reasons. I could say two and a half. One was we believe that's what people are recovering, you know, mm-hmm. wholeness, general of character, potential for transformation. Two, it was looking at our society, specifically the treatment industry, and the lack of integrity that we saw existing in the world. And so it was also sort of just a message or a signal to the world. And the little half part is also a reminder to ourselves of what our core value and mission is, that we also have to be in integrity, and that one of the, you know, any parent knows this. I have three kids, right? So there's teaching your kid, there's being like a smart parent, you know, and trying to teach your kid. But we know that kids learn the most from how you live, you know, meaning if you're living with integrity, that's the best teaching modality. You know what I mean? And so me as a counselor, which is often, I could parallel that to a parenting process, as a counselor or a psychologist or whatever, it's so much of that role modeling integrity. You know, not for the sake of role modeling integrity, for the sake of living in integrity, which resonates with people, you know, and people see it as a different way to live. And so, you know, there's a it's a huge theme within what we're doing.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Oh, it's really hard.
I was just going to say, yeah. I mean, but walking the walk is hard. But seeing, you know, when people see it in you and you become that person for people, whether it's the counselor, the mentor, the spiritual leader, whatever it is that they look to you for, it's an energy. It's an energy of actually believing that they could achieve something like that too, which is the most powerful because it gives people hope. You know, when people are in an addictive state or been coming out of a long period of self-betrayal, they do not understand that there is that kind of hope. And for someone like you to say, listen, I've been at the depths, I've worked my way through it. And not only have I worked my way through it, but I have learned to develop what these values are and how they help us when we're trying to create a new life.
You know, I'm so glad you bring up the word hope, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's such a huge, I think that, you know, we so often get lost when you work in kind of a semi-psychological field like addiction treatment. And on some level, much of what we're doing, or some of the ideas that we're trying to express or inculcate in our clients are these really old ideas, you know, kind of like happiness, hope, truthfulness, you know, these kind of principled spaces. And if a person can cultivate enough hope in their life, you never see somebody who wakes up with a tremendous amount of hope and is able to sustain that through the day that has, you know, huge emotional problems. You know, it's like you can't be a hopeful person and be able to sustain that foundationally and be depressed at the same time. You know,
right.
So when you bring those words up, it really kind of it resonates with me, you know.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, like you said, we go through emotional waves every hour, you know, I mean, there's big ones and then there's small ones. But I think an overarching theme that you could choose for your life is to have faith and hope, you know, and have faith and hope based on, hey, this man, Yeshaya, did that, you know, or he's living a life like this, or these are his choices, or this is her choice or whatever that is. And to actually, especially in recovery, I think that, you know, everyone out there wants to relate. Everyone wants to feel like they're not alone in their own problems. But especially people in recovery, they feel so isolated and alone, and what they're doing is so bad, and no one could possibly be doing the same thing they're doing. And then they come to see that, no, we've all kind of dealt with one thing or another, whether the stories have changed, the names have changed, right? So I think to give hope to people like that is really what keeps people, I think, on the path towards healthy living and sobriety, is to understand that, yeah, it may be difficult now, but I'm going to learn how to tolerate these feelings because there's hope on the other side.
Yeah, I think, you know, I said to you a minute before we started the interview, how do you stay so enthusiastic, you know? And I think one of the real struggles is we live in a society where we all are compelled to market our personalities. You know, where it's like, I have to slap a smile on my face. You know, you can't call me on this interview and say, how are you doing? And I say, God, actually, I had a rough night. I was really mean to my wife yesterday. You know, well, why? Because, you know, it was true, by the way, right? I'm the exemplar. So I have to, you know, and so there's so much, for lack of a better word, phoniness in our society that it becomes really difficult for a person to find that authentic hope. And so when you say people in recovery look at other people and they don't think that they can relate. Well, there's a real reason, because everybody's walking around wearing multiple masks and making everything look really good on the outside. You know, so people look at me and my wife and my children or whatever it is, and my relative stability, And they say, well, he has everything together. He doesn't have major problem stressors. He doesn't have existential angst. You know, he wants to live every day. That's not the case with any of us. Any of us that are actually honest with ourselves know that, you know, just being a so-called normal person, meaning waking up, finding some kind of legitimate happiness, contributing to the world in some way, whatever way that is extremely challenging. And nobody told me that growing up, you know. Meanwhile, I'm like trying to, you know, become president of the United States when I'm a kid with these big dreams. And nobody said, forget president of the United States. You know, it's hard to wake up and work at the post office, you know. I mean, there's so much lies, you know. So I think that piece is huge.
That piece is huge, but also you showing that you're human by saying, I do get in fights with my wife. I do have these challenges. It is hard to pay bills. I do feel insecure. I do feel stressed. I mean, but that is also just as real as, yes, I did feel enthusiastic hearing your voice this morning. I am enthusiastic to tape this show. You know, I mean, there are times, and I will admit it too, where I say, hey, how are you, to somebody? Or they say, how are you back? And I say, good, when I'm not good. I mean, but that's, you know, I mean, I think that's programmed, you know. I mean, a lot of us are programmed in that way, but I think the people that do actually have the opportunity to look at themselves, like you and me and many other people out there, have more introspective. It's hopefully we get to embrace the idea that not everything has to be pretty, that we don't have to always put on the shiny mask, and that, you know, that there is some validity and truth to actually saying, you know, I'm not doing well, and that's okay too. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, right?
Well, and in that space of honesty, right. I mean, I'm also enthusiastic to talk to you quite sincerely. I've been looking forward to it all week, right? So in that space of honesty, I get on the phone with you. I say, you know, I'm not doing so good. We have a real conversation. And somewhere in this conversation, an authentic conversation, we find something that I can't put words to, you know, which is some kind of aliveness, hope, and gratitude for being, if we work hard enough. And so that real hope is related to a certain level of authenticity. You know, it's not a distracted hope. It's not a I'm hiding from my true emotions hope. It's finding that place of authenticity and connecting to others in a real way and getting outside of ourselves. And there's some kind of harmony that's produced there that gives me hope, wholeness, and well-being, you know, in my life. And that's you can't put that into an equation. It's a great challenge, but it's a really holy challenge, you know.
It is. But it takes a lot of action and it takes choices. You know, I think the one thing that you just brought up was the fact that that's a choice. You know, it's when I got sober, it changed my life. I felt like, wow, I actually can create and I have choices. That was empowering to me. And like you said, we choose our thoughts also. And I know that a lot of fear-based thoughts, and fear in general, is something that people struggle with, people that you and I deal with day in and day out. And really, I've been doing a lot of contemplating on what fear really is, and are there stages to fear? And I want to get your opinion on it. And I think a little bit of the first step is at least being aware of the fear and taking ownership for it. And then obviously, like, some at some point taking actions. But how do you feel about fear, and how do you move through fear in your life, and what's your relationship with it?
Boy.
I know. But I mean, I know, because you know, you're somebody that I value your thoughts. And so, but fear is something that I think at all stages of our lives, when we first get sober, we're fearful of what is life going to be like without substances. Yeah. And then it's like, we find out it's fine. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's the best thing ever. And then it's like, oh, I got a relationship. I have to be vulnerable. I have to show myself. I have to actually let down my guard. That's a fear. And then obviously you had children, the fear of being responsible for other people, and then creating a treatment center like you have, and now you have more people. I mean, how do you deal with that emotion? And you know, maybe you don't call it fear every day, but
sure. I think so the first thing I would say, and I'll talk about it kind of personally in my life, and maybe we can talk about, you know, in general fear. The first thing I'd say is I'm grateful for a certain amount of denial that exists in my life every day. And I think we got to acknowledge that, you know, that one of the things that allows us all to function is that we're not completely aware of all of the things that are happening. And so there's a gratitude that I have for not being aware of, you know, all of the things that are happening, because it's very frightening. That's first.
Yeah. Yes.
Second, you know, I started actually really early in my own recovery, even when I was in treatment, where my fears were about fears of loss of some kind. one way or the other. It was loss of a relationship, whether it was, you know, gaining some success and losing it, whether, you know, it was fear of loss that I couldn't control. And I think a lot of our fears are based on that, you know, because loss is painful, okay? And I'm afraid of pain because it hurts. That's a human problem.
Right.
So one of the things that I started to do early on, and sometimes I work with people at this, is I was able to kind of strip away the window dressing of life, you know, and say, okay, what are my biggest realistic fears right now? And one of them early on in recovery was that I wouldn't be able to build a normal life at all.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was able to kind of do was imagine a scenario where none of my dreams came true, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of success
yeah.
in the world, because that was my big fear.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be successful in the world. And I lived in a one-bedroom apartment. You know, I had a kid early on, maybe with my kid, that I walked across the street to the school. And I had, you know, a handful of good relationships and, you know, decent food. And that was really it, you know, that I really didn't build any major success in the world. And that was my biggest concern. And then I went, well, God, that's not so bad. You know, what is life really about? Well, life is about my relationships. Life is about finding some happiness. Life is about being able to do something meaningful every day. And so a lot of those fears, a lot of the fears that I had couldn't impact how I expressed myself in the world. You know, that I was able to see that I had choice every day at some level at how I would express myself in the world. And all those things I can't control, I can't control. But I can control to some degree how, you know, who I am in the world. And that gave me a real foundation to say, well, whatever happens, I have some say in who I am in the world.
Absolutely. That's empowering in itself. That's very empowering.
Can be. Yeah, it was helpful, you know.
Yeah.
What's the worst case scenario here type of thing?
Right. But so do you feel like that there is some value in visualizing, like you said, the worst case scenario and I understand how that would be helpful because it's usually the worst case is still better than someone else's bad day.
Yeah.
But also do you believe in setting intentions? You know, I was talking to I was talking to another therapist who was on the show last week and I worked with him before. He's an incredible healer and therapist. And he was just saying how he really manifested his relationship with his wife and his kids and his practice. And it really by literally writing things down every day and visualizing not only how it looks, but how it feels internally.
Yeah.
And he did that day in, day out for years and it manifested.
Yeah. So I would say I don't prescribe any particular kind of modality, for everybody, you know. So if somebody already is kind of stuck in worst case scenario, you know, and it's not comforting for them, well, then no, I really wouldn't suggest that. You know what I mean? So in terms of the other though, like in terms of sort of the positive emotional side of, let's call it treatment, you know, whether that's intention setting or affirmations. Yeah. I mean, I think that's rarely going to hurt you unless somehow you're disconnected from yourself. And you're not able to get to the truth of your condition, you know, or the truth of your state in that moment. But in general, I believe deeply in the power of intention. I also experience randomness and loss, you know, and that's a reality too. And I think that we have to acknowledge that, you know, you know, bad things happen to great people. In terms of kind of waking up every day and having intentionality, right before I got on the phone, I closed my eyes and I set an intention to be honest and connected with you. You know, of course, like I think that has a tremendous amount of, I think that we have power far beyond what we think most days, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And visualizing things like that and saying things in your head like that, really, it almost like resets the direction of where you're about to launch. You know, if you're stuck in a pattern of negative thinking or negative self-talk, like some people have been doing for a very long time, and you go into a situation, whether it's a job interview or a date or a radio interview, it doesn't matter what it is, and you're still in that negative self-talk, That energy, man, is gonna be felt, you know, instead of saying, listen, I'm whole, I'm complete, I'm gonna, you know, do my best, whatever it is that you need to say, I'm wonderful, whatever it is, it really will shift your energy. And I just think that that's not talked about as much as it should be.
No, I absolutely agree. You know, and the thing that I recognize with people that I work with, and I think I read the term somewhere, but it popped back in my life a month ago, is this idea of an imagination horizon. meaning we all have some kind of structured belief system. You know, Scott Peck calls it a map, you know, of what's true and what's not. And we come in with that. When people are stuck in addiction, they're stuck believing certain truths about the world that keep them stuck and unhappy. And they can't get over it. You know, there's a wall, there's a boundary, there's a horizon there. And that part of what, you know, we try to do, I do it in my own life and I do it with people that I work with, is constantly broaden that imagination horizon, you know, so that things that you just couldn't see and that were beyond your capacity, you're able to get glimpses of and kind of, you know, jump over that wall a little bit. And that does have to do with some sort of reflective, interactive process that's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And action, you know, if you don't have a contrast, how do you know, you know, how do you know? You know, I always say to people, I get this all the time, you know, I can't do this, I'm bored, I can't do that. You know, it's always something, and I have you taken action? Like, how do you know? If there's no contrast, how do you see yourself? Yeah. If you haven't, you know, you've been in the dark, how do you know the light? You haven't even stepped into the light yet. You know, let's check it out. But it's very, you know, it's very, I think, important for people to understand, too, that your imagination is there to actually give you some inspiration, and without inspiration or without meeting other people that are inspiring, it's hard to kind of visualize what you're capable of.
So I want to go back to a term you used twice in the last 30 seconds, and then I would love to, I know we don't have that much time, touch on a little bit of the moral stuff.
Please. Mm-hmm.
And I think that they're related. So you use the word contract. And it's such what is it?
Contrast.
Well, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about contract.
Okay. But contract I like too. Yeah.
Like an agreement with yourself, you know, a commitment to action, right?
I was talking about that too, kind of. But yeah, so I was talking about the last segment, agreements with yourself. Please.
So I had a sort of a revelation last week where we have an admissions process here. Right. And admissions consists of, you know, 40 pages of paperwork and a biopsychosocial, you know, which is important, you know, legal information, et cetera, et cetera. But it dawned on me that really what we're doing is we're making an agreement with somebody. You know, I'm going to do this and you're going to do that. Now, can you agree to it? And that beyond all of the paperwork, it's that moment of agreement that's the most important, right? It's sort of like somebody's coming into my treatment center, being able to look them in the eyes and say, do you agree to this? And then be able to look at me and say, do you agree to that? You know? And both of us be attuned to each other. And if somebody says yes, but they mean no, then it's not an agreement, you know? And really agreeing and being present and saying, okay, you know, we're going to do this together. Like that agreement piece, it kind of sets the foundation for that action. And, you know, it's hard to fool yourself. So if we're talking about kind of that self-improvement and self-work stuff, you have to set an intention and make an agreement with yourself. And you also have to somehow, almost paradoxically, be able to be honest with yourself about your ability to commit to that agreement. I mean, there's something really weird about that, right? I can set intentions all day, and that can help maybe move me towards agreement. But there's another kind of interesting place where I'm trying to make an agreement or a commitment or a contract with myself where I have to be able to say, yes, this is that true moment when I'm really going to do this, and then move right into action. You know, it's a really kind of almost a mysterious thing. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just saying it's like that moment where, you know, you've been, I think when you make that decision to have things change, that only takes one moment, but it could be years and decades of contemplation and seed planting. And then all of a sudden you make that decision. I'm going to quit smoking. Boom. I'm going to get help. Boom. You know, I'm going to get married. Boom. I mean, it's amazing how it just takes a moment and our decisions are made.
Absolutely. It's almost as if it happens to you after you've been attempting to manifest it for either 10 days or 10 years.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. So let's talk about the moral issues around addiction while we have some time.
Yeah, I guess kind of what, you know, you had asked me what I wanted to talk about, and I brought it up. Yeah. And it was largely because I had been listening to radio and reading in the media a lot about recovery, and I had heard probably at least, you know, 50 times somebody say some version of, You know, addiction's not a moral issue. It's a mental health issue. Addiction's not a moral failing, et cetera, et cetera. And every time I heard it, I was just like, wow, that's just not true at all. Do these people not understand what morality is? I understand what was motivating. It was motivating it as people trying to say, addicts can't help this behavior, which is true to a certain degree, but it's also, you know, it's really not an empowering way to look at addiction. If you ask anybody who suffered from addiction and say, hey, you know, did you feel demoralized? Were your morals compromised? They would say, absolutely. If you ask anybody on the street, is addiction a moral issue within our society? They'll say, yes. If you ask anybody on the street, do you have moral failings? They'll say, yes. And so part of it is, I can't understand why it becomes so difficult for us to say that as human beings, we have moral failings. You know, it doesn't mean I'm a bad person, or I'm sinful, or I'm going to go to hell, or anything like that. It means I have problems and I sometimes betray myself. Well, look around at the world. Of course we do that as human beings. And the last piece is that if you look at the addicted population, what you see is a lot of moral disturbance. And people know that who work with addicts. I mean, it's the case in the world, but it's much more prevalent in the addicted community. I know we don't have too much time and it's a much longer conversation, but I wanted
Well, I'm happy you brought it up, and I agree with you 100%, actually 200%. You know, we need to also talk about these issues because we're not, no one's perfect, and we do have moral failings, but we could also rise, get back up, and really create a new life for ourselves. So, Yeshaya, thank you for coming on and talking about these really important, inspiring issues, things that we actually have to get the conversation starting about. So, I thank you for being on with me. You can find Yeshaya at Recover Integrity Treatment Centers, and I'm Erica Spiegelman. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. Thank you all for joining us, and stay well.